Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello there, how's it going? Welcome to this week's Zonal Marking Podcast with me, Ali Maxwell, and today, solo, Tom Warville. Tom, this is exciting. No Michael today, and today's topic feels a little bit like when your parents leave you at home as a youngster and tell you not to do certain things, so you absolutely do them.
Yeah, definitely, Ali. We're in the hot seat when we've decided today to go through each of the 24 championship teams and, I guess, bring an NTT20 flavour to the Zonal Marking Podcast. So we're going to be going through each team, through the teams and players, and talking through some of the interesting trends behind the numbers this season.
Coxie, being as he is, uber focused on the top tier. It's a good week for him to be off. He'll be absolutely ticking that he was a parent in that analogy that we used in the intro. But no, you're right. We're going to head through the Championship League table from top to bottom, catching you up with the trends, the teams and players that you need to know about. There's 1 month left of the season. And this for me is really where the EFL and following the EFL comes into its own. If you've taken a few months off following Championship football, now's the time to switch back on, because the run-in is always exciting and unpredictable. You have, unlike the Premier League, where often, you know, the most exciting thing heading into the last few games is the battle for the Champions League, which is kind of almost a manufactured product. In the EFL, you've got that beautiful duality of promotion and relegation, the agony and the ecstasy of playoff football as well. I think you get the picture. I don't need to sell it much more. But Tom's on hand here to provide the analysis, and I'll do the frills. Some people say you can't possibly give insight into 24 teams within 1 hour. And to that I say, I probably agree with you, but we're going to do our best. And there's a reason why Tom Warville has been nominated as a Data Journalist of the Year here in the UK. So let's give it a go. Starting with Norwich City, who are well clear at the top of the table. They're 8 points clear of second, 14 points clear of third place, two automatic spots, of course. So we expect them to be back in the Premier League next season. They've only lost three of their last 34 league games. And Tom, no doubt in my mind, following these leagues each week, that they have been head and shoulders above every other team in the division. But I'm interested in the numbers here. For example, in terms of their attacking numbers, I see them as the most consistent chance creation team from open play, at least. Does that stack up with the numbers?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, looking at the last three seasons in the Championship, only Leeds in 2018-19, so obviously the year before they were promoted, created more chances from open play. They created 10.5 per 90, whereas Norwich is around 10 per 90 this season. So that's a pretty good figure to have against your name, and shows you that they're kind of linking really well in attack with Buendia, Cantwell, Lucas Rupp at times as well. And that's also ahead of their previous campaign in the Championship in 2018-19, where they were creating 9.2 of these chances per game. So in terms of open play, chance creation, Ali, doing really well so far this season.
And I guess the big question for Norwich City and for observers of the Premier League is, are they better placed to make a good fist of it in the Premier League next season? A pretty desperate attempt, I think it's fair to say, in the 19-20 season, with a few mitigating circumstances granted. In October, we did a podcast on how to survive in the Premier League after promotion. So hopefully Stuart Webber and co have listened to that. I would suggest that Norwich will need to be significantly better defensively than last time they went up. That's not a particularly bold statement. Do the defensive numbers this season suggest that they are a stronger defensive side?
Their defensive numbers are pretty much the same as they were in the Championship in 18-19. They're conceding about one XG per game, so nothing's really changed there. They're actually a little worse going forwards. But, I mean, the biggest issue for Norwich from the Championship to the Premier League last time was just none of that really translating very well. The attack kind of, the bottom fell out of the attack and they relied so much on Teemu Pukki. And defensively, I think they were the third worst defence in the Premier League in the last three seasons. So, yeah, I guess the numbers haven't changed too much. But what's interesting is that this was a team that was so young in the Premier League last season. I mean, they relied so much on Max Aarons, on Jamal Lewis, on Ben Godfrey. They obviously lost Lewis and Godfrey, and they've all got a bit more experience and older at the back. So you'd think that that perhaps will put them in good stead if they go back up, that they can defend more cohesively as a team.
And we're going to pick out a player or two for most teams in the Championship here, players that we think maybe have an interesting skill set, who are young, talented players with an exciting future ahead of them. Of course, plenty of current players thriving at the top of the Premier League who did time, if you look at it that way, in the Championship. For Norwich, I mean, where to start, really? We've picked three, but we could have picked about five or six.
Yeah, we've gone for Emi Buendia, Max Aarons and Todd Cantwell. And with Coxie not here, we can use all the Americanisms we want on this podcast, which is going to be a lot of fun. And Buendia has had a double-double this season in terms of goals and assists, 10 goals and 11 assists so far this campaign, which is very tidy. And something that he really struggled with in the Premier League was scoring last season, was having shots. And he's only obviously showed that that is also a part of his game. Max Aarons, someone who potentially is the next name on kind of the selling list, the transfer list for Norwich in terms of raising cash and ensuring they can be ran as a sustainable club in the seasons going forwards. Someone who has got better this season at progressing the ball upfield. He's extremely tardy on the ball, I feel. I don't think he's quite conservative in possession. He keeps the ball very, very well, which we see per kind of smarter scout and their ball retention model for a right back. And then Todd Cantwell as well is someone who I think at times is quite a flashy player, but his contributions don't always show up in the numbers, but he's having his best season in terms of goals and assists per 90 and is improving. And bear in mind, he's still a young player, I think 23 years old still, so only going to get better, but he's probably having the best campaign of his career as well.
Yeah, he was pretty popular in the Premier League last season, and as you say, the development has been absolutely clear to anyone that's followed him over the last 3 years, so remains to be seen what his ceiling will be, but a really exciting development this season, Todd Cantwell growing into a senior attacking player in this side and giving them an extra dimension, really, on top of your Buendias, your Pukis, etc. In Watford, we've got a really interesting team because relegated from the Premier League last season, one of the favourites to go back up, as relegated teams always are. And it hasn't always been plain sailing this season. A managerial change about halfway through with Vlad Ivic departing after a few months and Thisco Munoz coming in. They're currently 6 points ahead of third place, having won five in a row. So they're in really, really good nick as we record. And I note that having said I felt Norwich were evidently the best side in the league, they've actually got the same goal difference as Norwich, having scored one goal fewer and conceded one goal fewer. What would a rolling XG graph tell us here, Tom? My gut feeling from watching a lot of these games is that their defence has always been strong this season, but the attack was pretty grim until Christmas. So in my head, at least, the attacking numbers would have really kicked on after the change of manager, the appointment of Thisco Munoz.
Yeah, it's an interesting one with Watford because it's such a busy chart, really. It's something we'll tweet out with a link to the pod once this episode's out so people can see it. But you see there's obviously a ton of managers. This is Watford after all. But we do see there's quite a bit of defensive improvement as the weeks have gone on this season. And they're probably at the best that they've been since perhaps the start of Harry Gratch's stint or the start of his 2018-19 season. And the attack has improved as well with Cisco coming in. So yeah, there's definitely clear signs of improvement and the team's getting better, which is good. It's what you want, especially when you're building towards promotion, but also sustainable promotion and not kind of yo-yoing between the two.
It took a while for them to find a settled team and shape. Even when Munoz came in, you know, this didn't happen overnight. It definitely took a few weeks for the performances to improve to the extent that we now see them as clear second favourites for promotion and in a very strong position. I think the introduction of a few players that weren't in the first team for various reasons in the first half of the season has made a big difference. So if it's looking likely that Watford will take that second spot. I think fans of the Premier League can look forward to seeing a centre-back called Sierralta, who's been transformative since he's established his place in this side. Adam Messina at left-back as well has been excellent, fantastic stamina and quality on the ball as well, but defensively sound. Will Hughes has been a big part of the team since the turn of the year, having struggled for fitness, which is what we've said often in his career. But Hughes is still only 25 years old. He's currently on a brilliant run of form, and Watford have barely lost since he's come into the team. That's no coincidence because of the quality that he has on the ball, but he can mix it as well. He's not exactly, you know, he's not a soft touch in the centre of the park. So those are some interesting players, I think, that have made a big impact since growing into the side. But Tom, in terms of players in focus for the wider audience, there's got to be a couple of young players to look at here.
Yeah, it's Mela Sarr and João Pedro, probably the two main ones in that regard. But I'm particularly interested in Sarr because we've seen quite a drop-off, in fact, of his numbers last season in terms of when you look at expected goals, expected assists, chances created, take-ons. All of these things which you may think would go up in the Championship, a league which is easier for, you know, most players when you're stepping down to score goals in and do more of these things in. And yeah, they've all kind of gone down. So that's definitely one that's intriguing. And yeah, whether, you know, his numbers will rebound again in the Premier League, maybe it's just the way that Watford play or the way that he's targeted in the league is the reason for that. That's definitely an interesting one of the numbers.
I would suggest potentially as well another factor, albeit I am surprised that numbers would drop. That is clearly unusual, or you wouldn't expect that. I think it's a tactical thing as well, more to do with the opposition than anything to do with Watford. You know, the very nature of being strong favourites for most games that you play in mean that they're coming up against a lot of low blocks, a lot of set defences, a lot of teams sitting deep and restricting space in the final third. And I guess that's where Sarr, with his incredible pace, you know, we haven't been able to see as many examples of that this season because Watford haven't been allowed to play in transition maybe as much as they would have done in the Premier League. So I still think he's been very, very impressive. You know, he just gets so much attention from opposition defences. But the most impressive thing for me has been, and this isn't very numbersy, I'm afraid, has been his attitude and his availability. I think we're constantly seeing teams that come down from the Premier League, and we as Championship observers get told about fantastic talents who are surely going to tear it up. And it's not always the case. And I think a lot of that can come down to situation, circumstances, poor atmosphere around the place. But Sarr has played, you know, 90 minutes of almost every single game. In fact, he's recently missed one or two, I think possibly down to that sort of wear and tear and fatigue. But that's been the most impressive thing for me. And yeah, I suppose my eyebrows were raised about, you know, 40, 50 million pound price tags. And certainly halfway through the season, maybe if you're looking at the pure numbers, you weren't necessarily seeing where that was coming from. But I think certainly if he can finish strong, get back to the Premier League with Watford, then it won't be long before he's catching the eye again, maybe with a bit more space to play into. And as for João Pedro, I mean, as a sort of complete forward, I guess, harking back to our glossary of terms for attackers last few weeks, he's fascinating because he's only 19. He's definitely shown he can mix it physically already at such a young age. He shows brilliant touches in the middle of the park, in linking play, and a bit of a goalscorer's touch as well. You know, his numbers aren't gaudy, aren't that amazing. But again, for someone of his age, I think this season would have done a lot for him. He's probably got more game time than he would have done in the Premier League and will move back up to the Premier League should Watford be promoted in a better place because of it. Let's move on to Swansea City. They're in third place as we record. They've been up there all season, despite, Tom, their numbers never really being reflective of a top two push in terms of the performance data, possibly not even a playoff team at times. I think defensively they were massively running hot earlier in the season. The one thing they were doing very well was restricting big chances from the opposition.
Yeah, definitely. I remember speaking to Stu James recently, who is one of our senior writers and is a big Swansea fan, and he was saying, Tom, I have no idea what the identity of our team is. They don't really seem to do much right, or there's nothing that really defines them, which I thought was interesting. And yeah, we look at the expected goal difference numbers, which is the quality of chances they create minus those that they concede, and they're about average in the league. They're ranked 11th for this by this measure, and that for us is usually a pretty solid measure of the quality of a side, really, their ability to create chances but also stop themselves from conceding them at the back as well. But to add a stat to that kind of big chances point you made, I mean, they're conceding the second fewest big chances per game at just over one, and that's with Reading. So definitely pretty good at the back of maybe, you know, conceding shots, but they're not obviously high quality efforts, and maybe it's quite tough to break down.
things have started to slip a little bit recently. Watford's good form allowing that gap to grow. And that always comes with a bit of panic from within the fan base, Stu James among them, of course. The main point of contention seems to be if we had a proper number nine or a proper goal scorer, we'd be higher in the table. Now, that's always quite an interesting one from a data perspective, isn't it, Tom? Is there something in that, or is it maybe chance creation that they're lacking?
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
I think it's, looking at the numbers, we see Andre Ayew's got 14 goals from 12.7 XG. So, I'm more interested in the fact that he's got 14 goals. The next highest is Jamal Lowe with 9 and Conor Hourihan with 5. So I think it shows that, do they need a proper number 9 goal scorer? It does feel like they kind of have one in Ayew who's providing a large bulk of the goals. My argument would probably be that they just don't have many scorers in the squad. You've got Ayew, you've got Lowe, you've got Hourihan. The other goals really are coming from Conor Roberts, who's flying down the wing, someone will perhaps get to, and Ben Cabango at the back, who I imagine is a threat from set pieces. But aside from that, there's not really many other clear scorers. And if you're relying so much on Ayew, you don't really have a solid backup if he's kind of not firing, really.
Mm. And in terms of players to watch, we've got a loanee in Mark Guehi, on loan from Chelsea, currently with the under-21s, of course, very highly rated. And the right wing back, you mentioned him, Conor Roberts, 25-year-old, came through the youth system at Swansea this year, really, really thriving. He's great to watch. I always think he wouldn't look out of place in the Welsh Rugby Union team. He's a real physical monster.
Yeah, Roberts is an interesting one. You kind of lump him in the stats among other left-backs and wing-backs, and he just looks more like a winger. Like, he doesn't really do any tackling. He's not an overly solid tackler, but he's fantastic at creating chances in open play and passing into the penalty area. So he's great. And another quick mention of Mark Guehi there, who you would imagine he gets another loan next season. Potentially he's ready for Premier League football. Very, very solid tackler, kind of in the top 10th percentile for winning his duels on the ground. And also wins quite a few fouls as well. I think he's someone who doesn't mind dribbling the ball out of the back, which in this kind of modern pivot towards possession-focused centre-backs and those that are comfortable on the ball, I think that he's a great example of someone who is ready to perhaps make that next step. Mm.
It's an interesting time to talk about Brentford, who are in fourth place. So much expected of them now, that it feels like they're slipping a little. The last few games, they've given away leads. They've drawn both of their last two, and of course, Watford pulling away. Pretty good numbers, though, throughout. I feel like you could have put a pin at any point in the last 5 years, and Brentford would have had pretty good numbers. They certainly, practice what they preach.
Yeah, certainly. They've got the best defence in the league and the second best attack, both by XG, and that's just behind Norwich. So, yeah, numbers are fantastic. I think they perhaps not create a chance at the right time or gone behind early and then had to fight back and win leads from there afterwards. That's just always a thing which will mean that maybe the XG numbers differ from results at times. But yes, underlying, this is a really, really solid team, one that is deserving of the place that they're in at the table, perhaps should be a little bit higher.
And it seems odd to ask this about a team that have scored 9 goals more than any other club in the division. But are they struggling a little bit for juice in attacking play outside of the remarkable Ivan Toney?
Yeah, I think it's crazy that he's got, Toney's got 28 goals in the league this season, but that's still less than half of all of Brentford's goals, which just seems a baffling stat, really. Perhaps. Sergi Canos, 7 goals. Joshua Silva, 5 goals. Marcus Fors, 5 goals. Brian Mbeumo, 4 goals. So there's not really anyone else who's hit double digits yet. Someone like Saman Godos as well is someone on paper you think is quite attacking. He's only contributed 3 goals and 3 XG. So, yeah, you imagine that they go to the Premier League and is that a solid enough group such that imagine Toney gets an injury, you think they really might be struggling there. So, yeah, they're an interesting one. One last thing on Toney. The record for the most goals in the Championship, I think, is Glenn Murray in 2012-13, where he scored 30. So Tony's got 2 off tying that record, 3 off beating it, and there's 9 games to go. So Brentford aren't going to win the league, but could be a very, very special season for Toney individually.
Not a bad replacement for England's Ollie Watkins at the price, I think the initial price of about £5 million, rising to 10 with various add-ons and incentive-based clauses. Barnsley are fifth, and it's a great time to talk Barnsley, not just because they have flown into playoff contention, but also you've just written about them, contributing to a piece with US-based writer for The Athletic, Paul Tenorio. Tom, you wrote a piece about Barnsley and part owner Billy Beane wasn't mentioned at all. What?
I'm going to blame Paul for that one. I mean, I feel that that's probably a strike against my name in certain analytic circles. Not even the word Moneyball was in the piece either. I don't think. So, yeah, two strikes perhaps. But Paul managed to get an interview with Daryl Dike, or Daryl DK, I think it's pronounced, who is on loan from Orlando City and has really hit the ground running. He's only 20 years old. He is a absolute unit of a player. I was fortunate to see him live against Brentford on Valentine's Day a couple of months ago now, and he was just really eye-catching and very, very good at just disrupting the flow of the match. And he just fits Barnsley's style perfectly. I mean, PPDA wise, they don't show up too highly for the season as a whole. They're sixth in their overall PPDA of 10.9. PPDA, for those that don't know, is passes per defensive action. So how many passes do you allow the opposition to make before you stick a foot in and try and win it back. But since December, that's been the highest in the league, which is really when results have started to kick up, and that's dropped down to 10.2. So very, very aggressive pressing team. But the thing I'm more interested in is that when you look at the cadence of kind of possessions in a match and how the ball moves from one side to the next and how they kind of have possession, turn it over, you usually get on average about 102 possessions in a game in the Championship per team. That is. And for Barnsley, that shoots all the way up to 123 possessions per game. So there's just so much disruption. It's very much kind of the, let's go for the Phoenix Suns and their kind of 7 seconds or less attack. And the way that they would, play the transition, look to go end to end so quickly. That is exactly how Barnsley look to play. The next highest team in terms of that possessions per game chart is Coventry with 108. So there's a huge gap there. And it just shows you how different really Barnsley's pressing and, I guess, high octane style is, really.
They do a lot of things differently. Amazing use of the fact that you can make 5 substitutions in the EFL this season. Valerian Ismail is not afraid to make 2 or 3 subs at half time, quite often takes off all 3 forwards and 2 central midfield players before the 65th minute. It's something that helps them maintain that press throughout the game. But also on the extreme level, when it comes to the age of their squad.
Yeah, it probably helps that, you can make the 5 subs, but you're bringing on not just fresh legs, but young ones as well. I mean, I looked across all of Europe, including the Championship, and I think that they are, in terms of the weighted average age of the team, so if you weight the player's age currently versus the amount of minutes they played, they're the second youngest team in Europe behind Nice, who, if you look at Nice's, the kind of age chart for them, it's William Saliba's in there, Amine Gouiri, loads of really young quality players, and Barnsley are the same. They're just chock full of kind of young players who similar height, similar build, but they all kind of allow them to play this really neat pressing style. So yeah, a lot of fun Barnsley. Maybe one for the purists, but in terms of, like, we talk about quite unique FC the other week and teams that have very clear tactical identities, I think Barnsley are a great watch, really.
Yeah, they're definitely the outliers, the unicorns, if you will, of the Championship. Clinging on to sixth spot is Reading. They're in the last playoff place at the moment. Now, my opinion is that their sort of base level is more of a playoff chasing team in the sort of 7th to 12th range. But they started the season with 7 wins and a draw in their first 8, 22 points from a possible 24. Now, as I say, they've sort of slid down from that point, and I think their playoff spot is quite vulnerable. Would the numbers back that up?
Yeah, I think so. I think that really hot start covers up a lot of faults, I guess, in this team and shows that perhaps underlying-wise, they're not as good as their place in the table suggests. I mean, looking at their games until the end of October, they scored 16 goals from 6.8 XG, which is a ludicrous overperformance. And the next highest, that's, I think, overall, looking at non-penalty goals, it was 9 goals more than you'd anticipate, given the chances they had. The next highest in that list in the Championship at the time was Bristol City, who scored 0.84 more goals than you'd expect. So yeah, Reading were definitely firing on all cylinders, but maybe weren't creating too many good chances. So yeah, I think that, again, that they are probably the most likely team to fall out of there if one of them is to.
Fun team to watch, though, aren't they? A few academy graduates in the first team, a couple of young superstars as well. Michael Olise has 5 goals and 10 assists, still a teenager. It's amazing, really. Proper debut season stuff. And Omar Richards, the left back, he's heading to Bayern Munich on a free in the summer. And my personal favourite is Ovi Ejaria, the dribbly legend, as I call him.
Yeah, I contribute to a piece with Nick Miller not so long ago on Richards, which is definitely worth a plug and worth a read. And you can see that he's a pretty comfortable in possession, pretty dribbly winger, and also someone that is confident and capable on the defensive end of the game as well. So he's a very interesting pickup from Bayern Munich, and imagine someone who will perhaps see in the Premier League or you know, amongst a bigger team in Europe in a few years when Bayern probably flip him for a nice profit. Ejaria, 5.1 dribbles per 90, is 95th percentile and above, and his completion rate is pretty good as well. So yes, dribbly legend definitely is apt alley on that one. And Olise seems like he's more of a passer. Very nice passing numbers into the box as a winger and into the attacking third. So perhaps something, again, that he's been linked with a lot of teams. And imagine this summer, if Reading don't go up, maybe they look to cash in on him from there.
He can definitely carry the ball as well. But yeah, Olise, quality in his left boot is quite spectacular, I would say, for someone of his age playing at this level. So if they are vulnerable, we need to work out who's most likely to take their spot in the playoff places. How about Bournemouth in 7th, relegated from the Premier League last season? A bit of chaos off the field. Reports yesterday of a £60 million loss in their latest financial reports. They've also changed manager this season, sacking Jason Tindall, who was Eddie Howe's assistant, and hiring Jonathan Woodgate, who had a tough time with Middlesbrough in the Championship last season. So it's all been a little bit peculiar, and yet here they are, not a million miles away from the playoffs. I still don't really know what to make of them, Tom. Do you think they're the most likely to punch their way in?
Perhaps. I mean, they were the 5th best team, if you look at the whole season, by expected goal difference, but of late, that's dropped down to 12th. So it doesn't seem like they are really trending upwards, let's say. So yeah, they're definitely an interesting one. I think that Dom Solanke was having a really, really good campaign until I think he was injured recently, and that, I think it's always nice. I mean, you're in the kind of Bamford Solanke school of strikers who get a lot of stick because they couldn't cut it at a high level early in their careers, but then obviously come back and work on their game and show that they actually do have value up front. So I think that maybe this isn't a team that perhaps can make their way into the playoffs. Remains to be seen. But yeah, I think there's been a couple of good individual performers. I mean, Ali, you've noted here, Dan Juma as well is another interesting one.
Yeah, my favourite player to watch, I think, from a neutral perspective, wide forward who tends to play off the left. Obviously, he was very highly rated in his youth career in Holland and then in Belgium, and maybe just made the move at the wrong time, I suppose, to a Bournemouth side that ended up getting a relegation that wouldn't have been on the cards or wouldn't have been expected to be on the cards. But just a really direct, dynamic, skillful wide player who has chipped in with quite a lot of goals. I note from your numbers that his 10 goals have come from 5.4 expected. So maybe finishing a little hot this season. Certainly, if you watch his goals back, they're all beautiful strikes from, you know, the left corner of the box into the far top corner. So certainly a skill of his, but maybe we couldn't expect him to continue scoring at this rate unless he was to start getting on the end of a few more chances. But 3rd for non-penalty goals and assists per 90 in the league this season. If he hadn't missed a fair amount of time through injury, I think Bournemouth would be higher. What about Cardiff City in 8th? Mick McCarthy, a real stalwart of the English game, over 1,000 games managed. And since he was appointed, they've moved up the table, Tom, basically fueled by an uber direct style of play.
Yeah, they're definitely direct under McCarthy. I mean, if we look at their direct speed, which is how quickly they move directly up the field in terms of metres per second, they're only behind Wickham, Rotherham and Barnsley by that measure. So definitely looking to use the long ball, long direct passes upfield quite a lot to you know, gain ball progression upfield and kind of stage attacks from there. And Kiefer Moore's a big part of that up front.
Kiefer Moore, one of the league's great target men as well, but showed for Wales in midweek, you know, a balletic feat as well when necessary in the penalty box. He's been a real revelation since signing for Cardiff, I think it's fair to say. He does turn the ball over on 45% of his touches, though, which is the worst rate in the league. So, you know, still some work to do when it comes to the ball sticking to him, but he has thrived under McCarthy's direct style of play. Middlesbrough, below them, managed by Neil Warnock, another member of the over 1,000 games managed club. People think of Neil Warnock a certain way, I think, Tom, and I think sometimes that's a little unfair. Certainly on the underlying numbers, this Borough team have been pretty impressive this season.
Yeah, very solid. I mean, they've got the second best defence by XG against, conceding just 9.2 shots a game, which is the third best in the league. And going forwards as well, I mean, the fifth best attack, a bit under their XG2, and I think a big part of that is Brittas Mbolonga scored just 5 goals from 9.1 XG, so I don't think he's alone in that, but he's been the biggest culprit for perhaps missing his chances. But yeah, I mean, I definitely have a soft spot for Neil Warnock. Probably found myself watching the Warnock documentary once a month during lockdown just to keep spirits high. And one stat I found, which for me flies in the face of what I come to expect of Warnock as a manager, probably because I've got that image of him and Paddy Kenny having a spat in the changing rooms imprinted on the front of my mind at this point. But I mean, one stat that I found which was quite interesting was that Middlesbrough foul their opposition and end their kind of sequences of play just 5% of the time, which is the lowest in the Championship. And I've maybe come to expect more from a Warnock side, which in our minds we have this idea of kind of old school English manager and, you know, get stuck into them and all this kind of stuff. But that definitely doesn't play out on the field. They're playing maybe not overly eye-catching football, but good football. And yeah, they're not fouling opposition quite as much as you'd perhaps expect also.
And one for Manchester United and Northern Ireland fans, Paddy McNair, the player in focus. He is their action man. I know you looked into the numbers and he's basically doing everything. You know, he plays centre-back, sometimes defensive midfield, sometimes central midfield, and that's kind of reflected in the numbers. I think he's in the 95th percentile amongst centre-backs for true tackles, possession adjusted, and also up there for passes into the attacking third, for shots, for take-ons, for fouls suffered. You know, that is a function of the different positions that he plays, but he certainly is all action. Correct. Millwall in 10th, with all due respect, not a ton to say, I don't think, that they basically play every single game on insanely tight margins. You'll notice a lot of drawn games, most of their wins or defeats by a single goal, often from a set piece. You know, it's still very impressive on the budget that they have and to have established themselves at this level since promotion about 3 or 4 years ago, which many teams have failed to do. In terms of players, I want to ask you about Jed Wallace, because he's a friend of my pod. He's a very popular guy and a popular player, and I think a bit of a one-man attack at times. Millwall don't score a lot of goals, but Wallace got a double-double last season, 10 goals, 10 assists. And I think he would this season if his teammates could finish a little better. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, perhaps not a double-double, but I mean, his numbers are definitely better than, his underlying numbers are definitely better than the actual goals and assists he's put up this season. I mean, 2 assists from 5.3 expected and 3 goals from 4.2 expected is underperformance in both. But combine those and look at it per 90, he's still in the top 25th percentile of kind of attacking midfielders and wingers. So yeah, still doing a lot of what made him so good last season, but has his teammates and perhaps his own finishing slightly to blame this season.
And Stoke in 11th, I'm afraid, huge mid-table vibes from Stoke. 42 goals scored, 42 goals conceded, 13 wins, 13 draws, 12 defeats. I'd like to see a defeat in their next game to even that up, make it 13-13-13. Interesting for onlookers potentially is young wide forward or striker Tyrese Campbell, who started the season really, really hot, son of Kevin Campbell and with a brilliant eye for goal, but ball-carrying ability as well, great skill. And he had 6 goals and 7 assists by the start of December, but then picked up a serious injury. And from that point, Stoke have basically gone from automatic promotion contenders, as it looked like they were, to very much a mid-table side. That's really affected them. But you think he's slightly overdoing his numbers or was running a little bit hot, which I definitely agree with, I recognise. I would say maybe a bit like Dan Juma, maybe just for the level, his quality in terms of finishing and the chances that he was putting on a plate for Stephen Fletcher was definitely eye-catching. And, you know, I'm fascinated to know what happens to him over the summer, whether someone might take a punt on him despite a serious injury, or whether, hopefully, we'll see him tear up this league next season. But a mention for a centre-back as well, young Harry Suter, absolute giant of a kid in his first full season in the Championship. He is an Aussie from Scotland. His brother plays for Scotland. He plays for Australia. In fact, hilariously for a centre-back, he has 4 goals in 2 games for Australia just because he keeps, you know, when they win 10-0 in some of their World Cup qualifiers, Suter tends to, doesn't even need to get off the ground to head a couple of goals in.
Yeah, definitely, Ali. I think both him and Tyrese Campbell have been a couple of players you've shown on your kind of Friday night segments on the TV, and I guess shows your A, your eye for talent, and B, Good scouting chops. Suter's definitely been someone who's dominant in the air. Like you say, you'd expect that for his size. 74% area win rate is the third best in the league. Really good, solid individual dueler as well. And 14 long balls per 90 is just so Stoke, irrespective of kind of who the manager is, and part of what makes him a kind of all-round package, both, you know, progressive passing, good in the air, good on the ground. So interesting player. I wonder if he's the one who gets a move in the summer, or perhaps it's Nathan Collins, the young Irish centre-back who's playing at Stoke as well.
I would say Premier League clubs outside of the top six seem to be perfectly happy buying young centre-backs from the Championship after only a season's worth of appearances. So it could be one to watch for sure. QPR are in 12th. They were much lower down before the end of January, but they've had the fifth best record since then, which has taken them away from any concerns of a relegation battle. Lots being put down to January additions, loanees from the Premier League, Charlie Austin and Stefan Johansson. Johansson, just a combative midfielder who's got quality in his left foot as well. And Austin's come in and provided what I think we knew he would, which is just more of a goal-scoring threat, more shots in the box, a better finisher than the strikers they had previously. But in terms of the player, we have to talk about Ilias Chair, because he's an exceptional player to watch, it's fair to say, and I love him. I think he's really good and someone who could thrive in a better team. But in data scouting terms, he's got a bit of a red flag, doesn't he? Because I would point to the amount of chances he's created, and you would point to how many of those come from set-piece situations rather than from open play, which might be a better predictor of how creative a player is.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you look at his expected assists from open play, it's low. His XG is low. There's nothing really there that speaks to me in terms of being a direct threat, but he seems like someone who's very much the passer before the passer at times. And I mean, from open play, he's averaging four passes into the penalty area per 90, which is top 20% of attacking mids in the champ. Although that is, there's just 18 of them who've kind of played in that number 10 space behind the striker or strikers. But there was to be fair, I feel that's probably a skill that can translate, especially to a team which has a lot of possession in the final third at times, or looks to build attacks within the final third. But there was a lovely one I was watching while kind of researching with this pod against Reading recently. I think it's Tom Holmes, who he kind of passed the ball inside out, and Holmes just completely stops, looks at the goal play out before his eyes, and then just hand on face. He's just, you know, been absolutely cut up by a perfectly played Ilias Chair, kind of sliced through the defence. So yeah, those sort of passes are extremely eye-catching. It's whether that there's more to his game than that, which so far the numbers suggest that there's not.
Luton are 13th, and they're a really interesting club to look at a little bit deeper, because in terms of budgets in this league, they're right down at the bottom. So very much punching above their weight, and all coincided with the reappointment of Nathan Jones, a manager who, well, essentially won two promotions with them to take them from League Two to the Championship, but just before the second promotion got poached by Stoke, a move which didn't go well at all, but still a fascinating and young manager who's thriving again at Luton, guided them to safety after lockdown last season, and now a mid-table team. What's their style like from the numbers?
Yeah, it seems like they press quite high up the pitch, but maybe not. It's not like a full court press, really. They're quite low on PPDA, but their high turnovers of 3.1 per 90, which is sequences that start within 40 metres of the opposition goal in open play, is the third highest in the league. And they allow opponents just 18 seconds per possession on the ball, which is the sixth lowest. So, yeah, out of possession, they look fairly press-happy upfield. But in terms of on possession of the ball, they turn their possessions into shots just a quarter of the time, which is the worst rate in the Championship. So perhaps that speaks to their direct style, and they're just trying to have more possessions to try and get more chances. But yeah, definitely quite, an interesting style for someone who's actually not really seen much of them at all.
And in the manner of many teams who have to punch above their weight budget-wise, they're going for a pretty data-driven approach to recruitment. They've hired Jay Sosik, who's been on this podcast before. Many will know him as Blades Analytic on Twitter. He's now their head of recruitment analysis, and they've got a big chunk of players in this squad who have been with them for 3 or 4 years as they've risen through the leagues. And I just wonder whether to make another step, there may need to be a careful sort of overturn or churn in the squad. And no doubt there'll be data at the heart of it. They've already picked up a striker from League Two called Elijah Adebayo. He's our one to watch because they signed him from Walsall right at the end of the January transfer window. And he's taken to Championship football very well, which for someone of his age is unusual to make that two division step quite so easily, I mean, maybe a slight overperformance so far, but he's huge. He's like 6'4", competes really well aerially, but seems to have a bit of a goal-scoring knack about him as well. You've said, looking at the profile, something of the Calvert-Lewin about him, which is obviously pretty exciting, but plenty of development until he reaches those levels.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Well, luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Bristol City in 14th. They have Nigel Pearson in charge as of about 2 months ago. Prior to that, they had one of the worst runs I can ever remember a sort of top half team having at this level anyway, sort of December through February. Have they settled down now under Pearson?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like things have changed a lot under Pearson. They still look quite bad underlying numbers wise, and things under Lee Johnson were just so much rosier, and just shows you the quality of the job he was able to do to continually kind of recruit and keep the squad competing around mid-table season on season. And it seems you've taken them out of the equation. There's a few kind of older players in there now, Chris Brunn, Adrian Mariapa, Chris Martin. The squad's an odd mix of kind of some very talented youngsters who aren't getting too many minutes and a kind of older core who are getting more of the time on the field. So yeah, there's a good squad here. It's just trying to work out how you make the most of it.
Yeah, one player that some may remember from Monaco days is Hannoah Masengo, who Bristol City paid a decent chunk for as a 17-18-year-old. He's kind of mixed success, I would say, at this stage. A central midfield player who's having to develop as he plays for the first team. Various managers have loved him and dropped him in equal measure, but I think he's an interesting profile, and that huge transfer fee certainly means he's one to keep an eye on. But through the academy as well, Bristol City are very active in this sense. Zach Viner's probably the one to watch for me. If you can picture Christian Bielik, I would suggest he's a similar type of player to that. Very versatile, can play centre-back, can play in a midfield role as well. You know, tackles, carries the ball, can pass forward as well. By no means a hugely creative passer, but very, very passable, so to speak, and one to watch, the sort of player I like a lot. Blackburn in 15th, Tom, crazy sort of story of their season, because early on, numbers-wise, they were right at the top of the XG4 numbers. They were just insane shot volume, and they've got worse as the season's gone on, which I think doesn't reflect too well on Tony Mowbray. You know, my memory of their last few months are they seem to end up with 5 attacking players on the pitch at the end of every game, but they don't really seem to be too cohesive. Do the numbers suggest that they've had a big drop-off in form throughout the season?
Not overly. I mean, they're still 7th by expected goal difference, and that's obviously a big difference between the 15th position of the table. So I always find these things interesting when those two things don't match up. And I wonder, it's like you said about they usually finish with a lot of attackers on field, whether it's just them running up the numbers when they're behind, or you know, when they're ahead, they're not really trying to extend their lead, and they're actually getting attacked on quite a lot. So yeah, that's definitely an interesting one. It does seem from the numbers there could be the makings of a decent squad here. And also, I think Blackburn focused quite a lot in terms of youth, and I think they picked up Harry Pickering in January, someone that we've spoken about on this pod before in the past. But a couple of young players that they have and have excelled this season. I mean, Harvey Elliott is such an obvious one. Mark Curry, who's been on this pod before as well, is working on a Harvey Elliott piece at the moment, and one stat he armed me with for this podcast is that Elliott's got the highest expected assists per 90 of all under 23 players in the championship, which obviously shows the quality of his passing, the quality of his creation. And he's probably, if he keeps going, he's probably going to beat Craig Conway's record of 13 league assists in 2013-14. He's definitely the last player to get more than 10 since Conway. So yeah, he's had a great season on loan from Liverpool.
It was already quite extraordinary that he was even on loan at the age of 17, but his performances have been certainly even more extraordinary, exciting for Liverpool fans for sure. Preston are currently 16th. They're also currently managerless, having parted company with Alex Neil, who's been with them for a few years. Suggestion that things have gone a bit stale. I don't think he's been really properly backed. You know, consistently their best players have left. And even in January, two or three key men, including Ben Pearson and Ben Davies, left the club. I don't personally think they've been that bad, but they are on a really, really poor run. And in terms of a player to watch, I wondered about maybe the goalkeeper Iverson, who's on loan from Leicester. He's been very good. Alan Brown of Ireland is a real sort of Swiss Army knife, can play in a number of different positions. But you want to talk about a player who maybe will be remembered by Everton fans who follow their youth teams.
Yeah, I wanted to speak about Ryan Ledson, who's someone who Phil Hay and I suggested as a cheaper, younger backup to Calvin Phillips, someone who his data profile shows him is extremely direct, always looking to get the ball forwards from deep. His ball retention is quite low, and I think he makes the most long forward passes in the league this season. So looking to replicate that asset of Calvin Phillips is as someone who looks to spray the ball out wide and forwards, but also someone who's really good in the air for his size as well. I think the smarter scouts aerial duels model, which kind of adjusts for the quality of players you're going up against, really, really liked his ability in the air in open play. So that was something which really stuck out for me with Ledson.
As well as your piece with Paul on Barnsley and Daryl Dike, there's an excellent piece on The Athletic by Simon Hughes on Preston, the sort of state of the club currently and the key decision makers. It's classic Athletic fare. I would massively suggest it, even if you don't think you're interested in Preston North End. If you're not a subscriber of The Athletic, theathletic.com/zonalmarking is the place to go. You'll get an offer of £3.99 for 6 months. Of course, we'd recommend all of the excellent writing on site at the moment. Nottingham Forest to 17th. They seemed relegation threatened early on in the season, but Chris Hughton was appointed to replace Sabri Lamouchi, and things have calmed down a bit. He's a very calming influence in general, the sort of man that will put you to sleep if you listen to him for too long. But, you know, he has massively improved their defensive numbers. The big story, though, Tom, in data terms, is just how poor they are, not just in creating chances, but also in taking those chances.
Yeah, I think finishing this season has definitely left Forest. I mean, looking at each of their players individually, Lyle Taylor, 4 goals, nearly 7xG. Lewis Graben, 3 goals, nearly 7xG. Knockhart, 2 goals, nearly 4xG. Ryan Yates, 2 goals from 5xG. And Yates' ones are interesting because I think he's only had a couple of really good quality chances in the box, and he's kind of got it all wrong, not really got his feet ready. And that's the same across the board. I think most of Forest's players have undershot xG, and that's been a big issue for them. But I just think it's probably down to bad luck, really. But you will hopefully see them bounce back either in the coming weeks or next season. So not a great one, but they've probably secured time in the Championship for next season. And hopefully, this is 2021-22 will be the time when Forest can really rebuild and look to march on back to the Premier League. But we say this every season, and it invariably doesn't happen at this point.
Currently reaping, and maybe next season they will sow. Which is especially a clever line because they have a player called Sambaso and another player called Loic Mbeso. So there you go. In terms of players to watch, they've got an academy graduate called Joe Worrell at centre-back, who's 24, who I think is quite interesting. And James Garner, of course, on loan from Manchester United. He's kind of divided opinion in the Championship this season. He was with Watford in the first half of the season and their fans didn't rate him at all. I suppose when you look back at what we spoke about with Watford, they themselves weren't a particularly good team in the first half of the season. Forest fans, much more enamoured with him. Paul Taylor, the Forest writer for The Athletic, has written a really interesting profile piece on Garner on The Athletic site. Next up's Huddersfield in 18th. Carlos Corberan in charge of this side. They've kind of flattered to deceive a little at times. They've been really impacted by injuries and their squad in general is a little bit muddled. They've got a bit of a Premier League hangover, I would suggest, as well. At their best, they've had some really interesting build-up play, possibly not surprising given Corberan worked under Bielsa for the last few years. They've done some really cool stuff, and I think, you know, if you're a fan of tactics, Huddersfield along with a couple of others are a team to watch, and Corberan a manager to follow. But they've also been very, very poor defensively, and yeah, I mean, it would be remiss for me to say they've been an excellent football team, but certainly one that I've enjoyed following because their games tend to be fairly entertaining. In terms of players, what do you reckon, Tom? A few months ago I would have flagged up Josh Caroma, wide forward with really high shot volume. He was kind of their main attacking threat, but he suffered a long-term injury. And I guess the other one that stands out is Pipa, who's an attacking wing-back currently playing at the Euros with Spain under-21s.
Yeah, Pieper was the pick for me, especially from the data. I mean, he's someone who has been picked up from Espanyol, who were relegated from La Liga last season. Didn't play too much for them last year, played about five games in total, minutes-wise. But really, really solid numbers in terms of creating chances and open play, taking on players. He does that a lot, roughly three per 90, although he doesn't seem amazing one versus one. Loves to carry the ball forwards, loves to fly into tackles. So very, very all-action kind of Connor Roberts vibe with him. But one of the fun things with him, which you'd hopefully or you'd probably see eked out of his game if he does get a kind of a high profile move this summer, is that he's averaging 1.1 shots per 90, which for a fullback is, it's up there, is a lot. But his quality of those shots is just 0.04 XG on average, which is very, very low. These are kind of wide angled shots, or those taken from tough positions when there's probably a better pass on. So a good player at 23 who's going to come into his prime in the next few years, and you can imagine him perhaps getting a move this summer, because data-wise, there's a lot to like there.
All Pieper needs is a peep of goal and he'll pull the trigger. And maybe we'd rather he started to work the ball into more dangerous areas. Derby are 19th. They are managed by Wayne Rooney, of course. Early signs of his first managerial tenure are surprising somewhat, in that defensively, they've been pretty impressive, but they seem incapable of scoring goals. Does that stack up?
Yeah, you look at under Rooney, I think, or for the league in total this season, they've only had 11 different scorers, which feels quite on the low side. And there's a lot of a burden of scoring. It's on the back of Colin Kazan-Richards, who, that, again, that feels like a very left-field move, but he's actually adapted quite well to the Championship and scored 7 goals in total this season. But after him, Lee Gregory, Martin Waghorn, 3 goals apiece. So, yeah, I think that there's stuff to like about Rooney's side, and he's coming and done well, and you know, hope that there's a good platform to build from, and they probably need a summer where they're getting players in that are going to fit Rooney's style. But there's a lot of youngsters coming through the academy as well, which I think Derby have always been pretty good at bringing through talent. I think of a long time ago now, Curtis Davies, Tom Huddleston, amongst many others. But Ali, there's been a few more this season which are potentially more exciting.
Yeah, there's been a group of academy players who thrived in the youth team together. They were playing in the equivalent of the Champions League at youth level last season, and some of them are making their first steps in the first team. Jason Knight's played the most minutes, sort of box-to-box midfield player with a kind of a very varied skill set. Probably doesn't excel at anything, but he's very, very lively, brilliant temperament. Then you've got attacking left-back Lee Buchanan, who's kind of made that left-back spot his own. Maybe a little suspect defensively, but the hope is that that will improve as the years go on. Silky number 10, Louis Sibley, doesn't always have an obvious slot in this team, but can provide a moment of quality in the final third, which they have been lacking. And then two-footed midfield metronome Max Bird, who again hasn't nailed down a spot in the team, but has plenty of qualities that I like a lot. Coventry are 20th, Tom. This is their first year after promotion from League One. Now, League One to the Championship is a big leap, and the last few years teams have very much struggled with that. So I think for Cov, survival would be huge success, but they haven't been that fun to watch this season compared to last. A huge struggle for goals for them. But I think maybe focusing on the positive, they're a really interesting side to follow if you're a fan of funky recruitment in second tier terms, certainly, and a couple of interesting players to look at.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Callum O'Hare is someone I think, Ali, you've noticed before, is a very, very hard-working, maybe defensive-minded attacking player. Gustavo Hamer's the one we'll talk about, but Tyler Walker as well from Forest, I think, was an interesting pickup, someone who did well on loan, I think perhaps on loan at Lincoln City, and yeah, has come in and been serviceable in the Championship and has chipped in with a few goals as well. But Hamer is someone who was really interesting coming from Pek Zwolle, I think. He's quite small but quite tenacious. Again, he's similar to Ledson, and that we picked him in that piece on Calvin Phillips' backups, and you'd imagine if Coventry were to go down, and maybe even if not, he could get a move this summer. But very low for kind of retaining the ball, loves to pass forwards, and also scored, I think, 5 non-penalty goals this season as well from midfield, which is really handy as well.
Birmingham are 21st. They're in a bit of a precarious position though, because Rotherham have 4 games in hand over them and are only 3 points behind. So Birmingham nervously looking over their shoulders with new manager Lee Bowyer having replaced Aitor Karanka. Tom, it was felt that Karanka was basically at this level an elite defensive manager who it was thought would struggle to put together a team that would create chances. And that was basically what happened, right? Except that they weren't good enough defensively to have them anywhere near safety.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, defensively, they didn't concede many shots, but those they did were pretty high quality. I mean, they were in top six, I think, in terms of XG per shot, which isn't great when you may prevent the quantity, but when the quality's that high, it's the same as conceding shots which are of lower quality, but more of them. But going forwards, I mean, that defensive focus is just completely at the detriment of the side being able to create chances. I mean, 19th for shots, 22nd for XG, 23rd for goals. That's really not a great return, really.
Mm. It's not the type of situation where players can thrive, really. So, you know, it's kind of slim pickings in terms of players to watch. Ivan Sanchez has been a pretty good pickup, sort of creative winger with a nice left foot. But in general, the recruitment has been so muddled for quite a long time now, a good few years. And Ivan Sunjic kind of sums that up. Croatian defensive midfielder, they paid 7 million euros for him, which at this level without parachute payment money is always going to raise eyebrows. And he probably hasn't had the impact that they would have wanted, and therefore has he lost a bit of resale value? Possibly. It just kind of sums things up really for them. So Rotherham are the ones chasing them down. They're in 22nd. Tom, in the last five seasons, I think they've been relegated, then promoted, then relegated, then promoted. And this time they're trying to avoid another relegation. They're an interesting side. They're in the mould of a couple of others we've spoken about. They take the aerial route. They're a team with high intensity.
Yeah, they're 17th best for expected goal difference, so perhaps better than the league position of 22nd suggests. But yeah, I just really like their profile and possession. So they average one sequence per game, which has got 10 or more passes within it. They're the second fastest speed upfield by the direct speed measure I mentioned earlier, and second for their share of possessions, which end at the final third. So I think from that you can paint a pretty good picture in your mind of the sort of football that Rotherham play.
They are perhaps sort of Barnsley light, I like to think of it as. And below them, Sheffield Wednesday, they're in 23rd. They were always kind of up against it this season. Started with a 12-point deduction, which got reduced to 6. On actual points gained, they would be level with Birmingham on 38. But with minus 6, they're in big trouble. 6 points from safety, albeit with one game in hand. But of course, Rotherham, as discussed, with 3 in hand over them. So up against it, they're on their fourth manager of the season. 3 of them permanent, in inverted commas. It's never permanent when you're Sheffield Wednesday manager, and one caretaker. And they got 50% of their total points tally in a run of 6 wins in 9 games between December and February. And, you know, you've looked at the numbers and we've sort of jointly concluded that was a little bit of a fluke. Conceded far more chances in that run than they created. You know, they held on to a couple of leads, riding it out at the end, and a couple of late winning goals as well. I think my main question to you was, how does it look on the numbers, if you can, on a small sample size, as to how Darren Moore has improved things since coming in? As mentioned, they had Gary Monk, Tony Pulis, Darren Moore. In terms of maintaining a style of play across a club, you couldn't really lurch from extreme to extreme more than that.
Monk was someone who tried to have possession but also press quite high. I mean, their PPDA of 11.3 is pretty high in the Championship this season, but they're creating really, really low quality of shots. I mean, less than 0.8 XG per shot is definitely amongst the lowest in the Championship, and just 10 shots on average. You then move to Tony Pulis, just 6 shots a game, slightly higher XG per shot, but still 0.08 is very low. So again, there's just no attack there. 25% of their passes were long, very standard for Tony Pulis, and PPDA of 20 is extremely, extremely passive, and 37% possession. So again, you've gone from pressing a bit of possession to no pressing and long balls. And now Darren Moore's back up with 9 shots a game, much improved XG per shot. I mean, it's probably, you know, mid-table to higher in the Championship. Possession's up to 47%, but the speed at which they play upfield is the lowest of the three. So more of a build-up approach, less pressing, but also creating better quality chances. So hopefully, for thinking kind of longer term, it's a step in the right direction with Darren Moore at the helm.
Yeah, I like that. That's really interesting. I agree with you. It might be too late for this season, but potentially, you know, could be one to watch for next season if they do get relegated to League One. And in terms of interesting players, basically none, I'm afraid. Again, their recruitment over the last few years, well, at first it was kind of expensive players that had no resale value. And because of that, they then had to cut their cloth accordingly, went through a transfer embargo, and have pretty much only signed freebies and loans since then. Not only do they not have a particularly prolific goal scorer, they got 3 players on 6 goals, but also barely anyone with a creative bone in their body, I'm afraid. So not been a great watch this season, Wednesday. And 24th, Tom, at Wycombe Wanderers, they were the sort of fairy tale story of the EFL last season, winning promotion through the playoffs from League One, where at that level they had the lowest budget in the league and were predicted to be relegated. So they shouldn't even be here. They are 24th. They've had a lot of plaudits this season for giving it a go, giving plenty of bloody noses, but they do have the worst points per game record in the EFL's three leagues. Do you think they've been unlucky or just not good enough for the level?
Yeah, probably not good enough for the level, which again, when you look at that budget, it's to be expected really, but this is a great mission for them in terms of getting a bit of championship money, taking it to League One and trying to be sustainable at this level and trying to build to be a top level League One / building towards being a championship team for the future. But I think star wise they're the most funky team of the league. I mean, they've had just 14 sequences in the whole season which have had 10 or more passes. Wow. Norwich have had 501 of these, and they're obviously the most direct team speed wise as well, so they're just getting the ball and lumping it forwards. I think 2.6 passes per possession on average, which is the lowest in the league. So again, you can paint a picture of the sort of football you're expecting from Wigan.
And of course, big Bayo Akinfenwa up top. He's had a long and storied career in Leagues 1 and 2. This was his first championship season and probably his final one as well. He has certainly been one of the players that's given the opposition a bloody nose, probably literally at times, but he has struggled in front of goal. 0 goals from 3.5 expected, a couple of big chances missed for sure, and 0 assists as well from 2.3 expected, which he can blame his teammates for. Right. I think we pretty much succeeded with what we set out to do. It's been an absolute roller coaster, Tom. But I hope you've enjoyed dipping down and talking about the second tier. It is, of course, the best league in the world. So enjoyed this?
Yeah, Ali, absolutely. Let's hope Michael takes another holiday at some point and we can do this again.
Now, it feels like too much to promise that we could do this for another second tier across Europe. But never say never. As always, guys, we really want to be steered by you and we love your suggestions on Twitter. Please get in touch with any of us with ideas for a whole pod, ideas for, you know, quick hits at the top of the next episode when Coxie's back. But, you know, we love your input. It's really what makes this podcast. We love how long a leash we have, I guess, in being able to chop and change our topics from week to week and keep things fresh. So do make sure you're subscribed to this podcast and to The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/zonal marking is where you can do that. And join us next week with a returning rampant Michael Cox. Certainly no talk of championship football then. But hope you've enjoyed it. Goodbye.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.